This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
Been in here, so it's great to be here. And I'm so glad you got to hear Shaila, at least on tape last week, introducing this series on the seven factors of awakening. And for those of you who might just be here this week, this is a set that can be seen progressively, or it can be seen as qualities that are coming and going all the time, the more mature our practice is, and that we need to keep in balance. And it begins with mindfulness, and then moves to investigation of dhammas, investigation of states, which gives rise to energy, which gives rise to joy, which settles into tranquility, which then steadies and collects the mind into concentration, which then ripens in equanimity. And when those factors are all balanced and mature, then the mind is in the perfect place to drop into liberation. So these are the seven factors of awakening. And I've been asked to speak about mindfulness this evening, which is the first of these, and also plays a central role all the way through in keeping them all in balance and in really enabling the unfolding of the whole series. So I took this opportunity to go back and look at the couple of the main suttas that are the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness. The Satipatthana Sutta. Sati is the word for mindfulness. Patthana, variously translated as foundation, basis. My teacher Gil has recently been calling it the application, the four applications of mindfulness, which I kind of like. And then the Anapanasati Sutta, which is mindfulness of breathing, sometimes called mindfulness with breathing, that carries the theme of breathing clear through all of the applications of mindfulness, and also talks explicitly about how that leads through the seven factors of awakening. So I went back and looked at these with two questions in mind. One is, what is mindfulness? You know, I've been doing this for 20 years, and that's still a very live question for me all the time. What is mindfulness? What is mindfulness in this moment? What am I not mindful of in this moment? What is happening in this moment? It's endlessly interesting to really try to discover in what way is awareness really aware, and what are we not aware of, and what are we kind of involved in the background that we're not quite aware of. And so I really invite you to just listen to some of my thoughts on what the Buddha has to say, and then really to take it as a life question for yourself that's really a lifelong investigation, moment to moment. What is mindfulness in this moment? And it's really hard to describe for each person. It's just beyond words when you get the hang of what it really means. So it's something you can really only experience for yourself. But I want to go back and look at what the Buddha has to say about this. The definition part of mindfulness from the Satipatthana Sutta calls out actually four phrases together. One who's being mindful abides contemplating one of these foundations, one of these applications, ardent, clearly knowing, and mindful, setting aside greed and distress for the world. So that's the official definition of mindfulness. And I want to talk a little about what I've learned and picked up and experienced about each one of those terms, trying to understand what they might mean and how they're actually practical in practice. So ardent, the word atapi, ardent is sometimes translated as diligent also. So both of those words, you know, there's a lot of popular mindfulness where it's a very laid back, easy thing. It can sound like just go with the flow, whatever's happening, you know, just being aware of it. And here's this word in the definition of it, ardent and diligent. So how do we apply that to mindfulness in a way that keeps the ease factor that we're actually heading for here? So it certainly is a quality that's related that's related to wise effort. Wise effort. Effort that's not overstraining, but that's finding just this right balance so that we're not just checking out, we're not spacing out. When we sit down to do a session of meditation, sometimes it's very easy to just think of it, okay, whew, I'm just sitting down, and not making a very clear intention of what you're going to do in that session of sitting down. And then it's easy for the mind just, you know, your mind has so many agendas, they just jump in there and your mind gets on a train of thought and the bell rings 20 minutes later and you've been on this train of thought the whole time, right? And so there is some diligence and there is some strong intention that needs to happen. It's not striving out of aversion to the unpleasant or greed for the pleasant, but it is keeping some keeping the light on. This mindfulness is turning on the light in our experience, and we have to exert a little effort to keep the light on. I also actually like that ardent has a sort of, as a translation, it has a kind of heartfelt quality to it. So we're actually caring about what we're doing is one way of understanding this. One thing that came to mind when I was thinking about this word is the first time I sat with a famous Burmese teacher named Sayadaw Upandita. He's a very famous, kind of scary teacher. I sat with him for a while. And the first time I went into an interview, something about the way I was describing my practice, I was clearly kind of in my tone of voice, is this what you want me to say? Is this what I'm supposed to be experiencing? And all he said to me was, you have to do this practice for yourself. And coming from him, that really hit me. Oh, you know, this isn't some trick that I'm doing to please the teachers. This is my life and my suffering or not, and I have to do this practice for myself. And so really taking that to heart, you know, you're bringing your own heart to it. You're bringing your own wish to be free from suffering to it. And that's what really provides this factor of ardency. Sometimes it's just, I'm tuning into it more and more these days, it's just this kind of poignant, heartfelt desire to just be simple, you know, and to just simply allow things to unfold. Let me just see what's happening. The wish to just let the world come to me and show itself and unfold in the way it wants to. And this heartfelt wish may be part of what inspires your practice. It's like your practice is motivated and inspired when you sit down. And sometimes it really, you need to exert some pretty strong effort. I was on a retreat, since I'm managing the kitchen over at our retreat center, I'm on retreat a lot in a sort of half-baked way, so to speak, half baking in the morning and half sitting in the afternoon. I didn't mean to say that, but it came out. Half sitting in the afternoon. And I just didn't want to be there recently, you know, enough is enough. And I was just in a bad mood and kind of, I was in my room cheating, looking at the phone and, you know, messing around and trying to find anything to do besides the practice. And finally I realized, I'm just wasting my time. This is restlessness begets restlessness, and I was getting more and more restless and more irritated. And I just made a very strong determination that I was going to drop into a state of mind like I was in the middle of one of my better, longer retreats. And I was going to stay with the breath, stay with the walking, lifting, moving, placing, breathing in, breathing out, noting every time I moved my arms or my hands. And I did that very, very, very diligently for a few hours. And it really brought me right back into the beauty and the power of this practice. And then I was really inspired to be there for the rest of the retreat. So sometimes this is ardency. Sometimes it's a kind of courageous openness. It takes some courage, the willingness to actually not know what's going to happen next, to not know what's going to happen on any scale. You know, all the things going on in the world, to you don't know which little twinge is going to twinge next when you're sitting. And sometimes I call on that to make myself interested in sitting. Hey, I don't actually know what the next sensation's going to be. Let me just open up and see. You know, and then that comes in. It's, if you can meet it with awareness, it's okay. And then that can apply. You know, it's just one little thing after another. No matter what big story is unfolding in the world, it will unfold in your life one little sense experience at a time. And if you can learn to be with it on that level, then it's tolerable. So then this quality of heartfulness, at sometimes it softens into a kind of tenderness and just a kind of intimacy with your life. Just this afternoon, I was, you know, half mindful, as I am most of the time, and I was making some tea, and I picked up the teapot, poured the water, and it was one of those moments when I was really there with the water. And it was just a moment of oneness with the water and out of a kind of ordinary morning. And it was so beautiful, this intimacy with the elements of life. You know, here we are, intimately connected with the life of this planet and the pouring of a cup of tea. So any time like that, you can touch into that. So this is everything that I tend to think of when I think of the ardency factor in the definition of mindfulness. The next factor is sampajana, which is often translated as clear knowing or clear comprehension. And this is probably the factor that's most resembles the beginning meditation instructions of knowing what's happening as it's happening. Another place that defines mindfulness in one of the commentaries calls out the quality that mindfulness sinks in, which I think is interesting. And it compares it to a pumpkin. If you put a pumpkin on water, an empty hollow pumpkin, it just floats and bobs along and gets carried along with the stream. But a big stone, for example, will sink into the water. And so when you're really with something, it allows it to reveal itself and to slowly unfold. So you're making this precise, direct connection with something that's happening. You know, if you've ever looked at a leaf for longer than a second, you know, you look at it, then you see more detail. Then you see, oh, look, all those little veins. Oh, look, all those little different colors of green that you can see in there. Just by staying with it, it begins to open up and reveal itself. So this quality of clear comprehension, of clearly knowing, is to stay with something and stay in direct contact with it long enough for it to begin to reveal its particular nature and its general nature as a something made of the elements that's constantly changing. Upandita used to give the instruction that it's like you're making contact with what you're paying attention to, like you're trying to pick up a piece of broccoli with a fork. So you're not too hard or you push it off the plate, and not too light or you can't really get it, doesn't really penetrate, but just the way, say, a well-cooked piece of broccoli. I'm on a cooking theme here. Anyway, trying to just meet it in a way that you actually sink into it and begin to understand it from within. It's also really the essence of this, the main move that the mind makes when we're being mindful, which is to recognize things as phenomenon. So not to be caught up in it totally subtly in the back of the mind, some thing that's happening to me that, you know, your whole world, you're immersed in that whole world of the thing that's happening, especially in regard to feelings, emotions, thoughts. What is it to see a thought as a thought? To see it as an interesting human phenomenon that's happened, it's got a beginning, a middle, an end, and then it's gone. You know, and to be able to see, oh, that's a phenomenon that's happening, rather than to go right into whether you believe it or not and what are you going to do about it and whether you like it or not. Stepping back from all that to see things in this sense of phenomenon that are happening at the sense doors is part of this clear knowing. So I think this factor is also involved in making the right adjustment to the lens of our attention. So sometimes it needs to be very broad. Like when you're very agitated, there's a lot going on, you don't feel well, your mind is busy. A very, very broad base of attention, like you're standing in a big field and you're bigger than everything that's going on and you're not trying to see the details exactly. I sometimes compare this to like holding a fussy child on your lap. You're like, the whole world is this fussy child that you're holding on your lap, and okay, okay, okay. and just all this is going on, and you just feel that you can hold it. Your awareness is bigger than the whole situation. So that's one way of clearly comprehending what's going on. You don't know much about it, maybe, but you know that what's going on right now is this big, confusing mess. And then other times, it's really interesting to get very, very narrowly focused. Like you might, sometimes this works for me when I'm really, say, wanting something, and I can't get the thought out of my mind, then I can tune in slowly to, okay, wanting is happening. What does wanting feel like? What in the body is driving this wanting? What is it that feels so unpleasant if I don't think I'm going to get what I want? And then I can feel just that feeling, and then I can just stay with that feeling until it becomes a kind of pulsing wanting like that. And then even the concept of wanting goes away, and it's just this, the physicality of whatever physical phenomenon lay behind wanting, and you're just feeling that. You're staying with it in a very focused way to deeply understand what's going on there, and that can be very freeing at times. So clearly knowing can be clearly knowing a lot of detail or clearly knowing a whole big field of chaos. One of the ways that practice keeps deepening is realizing that we can clearly recognize even states of sleepiness and confusion and chaos. The part of the mind that can say, you know, the part of the mind that wants to complain, say, I can't meditate because I'm so sleepy. Well, wait, you know you're sleepy, right? You're just telling me or someone that you're sleepy, or you're telling yourself you're sleepy. See if you can tune into that part of the mind that knows that sleepiness is happening. That part of the mind is not actually sleepy. It's not affected by sleepy. It's not unable to know it's sleepy. And the same with confusion or all sorts of other states. The more you can be clear that there is a recognition, even if you don't know the exact word, you don't have anything to say except that right now it's like this, something in your mind knows that right now it's like this. And that's the part where you're free from it. That's the part where you begin to get a little space around what is happening. So combined with the first factor of caring wholeheartedness, there's this kind of soft readiness to see what's happening. The intention is to see and to know and not to judge. I like this quote from Nisargadatta Maharaj, who's a Hindu teacher. He says, mindfulness is the affectionate awareness that brings reality into focus. You know, it's such a coming home to just zoom in to, oh, right here, right now, this is what's happening. So then the third quality is mindfulness, which is a translation of the word sati, as I'm sure you mostly know. And you probably also know that sati actually means remembering. Maybe you didn't know that, but it does. And so that's kind of interesting, because this practice that we think of so much about being present and being in the now and being here, the actual word is remembering. So how does that fit in with the conventional notions? And there are actually lots of different thoughts on this. I've been reading books by Ajahn Tanisaro and Bhikkhu Anālayo and all kinds of great scholars of this, and they have slightly different takes on what it means. In my own experience, I think it's pretty clear that there's an element of simply needing to remember what you're doing, remember to be here. That's 90% of the challenge of this practice, actually, is remembering, right? Remembering that this is your intention to do. And so, for me, there's an element when I have been wandering and I come back of remembering. Oh, right, here. And so, you know, to me it's clear that that's an element of you're remembering your motives, you're remembering your intention. If you're not having that ardency, you may need to think a little bit about, now why am I doing this? Why do I care? What is my motive here? So bringing all that to bear is perfectly legitimate part of the practice. It's bringing in the faith faculty and getting yourself back remotivated to do it. And it also supplies a framework for understanding our experience, because this is a path that goes somewhere. It doesn't just go to wandering around enjoying the wine and, you know, I don't know what popular mindfulness might be, you know, advocating that people are just enjoying themselves somehow. That's a part of it. But also, it's going somewhere. And so you can remember to understand your experience in terms of what you've learned from Dharma, from reading, from Dharma talks. It's very powerful and very important. And so there's an element of memory in simply perceiving, oh, right, this is a moment of suffering. Being able to relate that instead of automatically following into the, oh, there's something wrong with me, I'm not happy here. You can relate it to the teaching that, yes, the suffering is universal, and that's what we're working on here. And so you're having an experience of the First Noble Truth, which is quite a different thing than there's something wrong with me. How come I don't feel good? And so it's this element of memory is applying the Dharma to your experience. And I also feel like it's, when I'm mindful, it's a sense of holding an open space that's normally completely filled with mental jabber, you know, but it's holding the open space and giving a chance for wisdom to arise. And wisdom comes from memory. It's a kind of long-term learning the lessons of life that's happened. And so there's an element of memory in just leaving the space. You don't go grabbing for it and trying to figure it out, but you're sort of holding the space for memory to come forward that's useful of what to do in that situation or how to attend next. So, you know, we might have learned that we've all the lessons that we've learned, you know, it could be something like a favorite fantasy, but you finally learned that it's a dead end and you're not going to do it again. Or you may have learned what's a safe place in the body that you can feel when you're over-triggered in some emotional way. You've learned how to go to your body. So letting all those things in are very much part of the mindfulness practice. Also in daily life, I feel that so many lapses of, you know, wrong speech or wrong action or forgetting some piece of wisdom I thought I had, It has this element of forgetting, as I just used the word forgetting. So non-mindfulness feels a lot like forgetting. And being mindful feels like just remembering to kind of call in the holistic, everything you know about how to be in that moment, although not with the mind that wants to grab onto it and make sentences out of it, but just with the sense of what to do here in a bodily, attentive sort of way. Also, I feel when you combine the clear comprehension, the right scope of mindfulness, with this sense of letting wisdom have a chance to get in, there's a great feeling of safety. It's one of the things I love most about mindfulness practice, is it's this growing sense of confidence and empowerment and safety, because I don't feel so much like I'm fighting a rear guard action with what my own mind might do or what I might do next or what emotions might arise. It's like being kind of, you know, on a hill where you can see all around you in a way. And it's like if some emotion is coming, you can kind of see it coming. It just doesn't take you over quite so instantly, and you're not so prone to do something that you'd be sorry about. So safety from your own bad habits, essentially, and safety from your own emotional reactivity that comes from these qualities. So then the last quality, setting aside greed and distress for the world. It always puzzled me to read that in the definition of, so you're going to sit down and learn to be mindful. Well, first, set aside greed and distress for the world. Well, wait a minute. Isn't that like the end? Being able to do that, that's very hard to do for the most part. And I, you know, it's very hard to just sit down and set all that aside. But it's important to have it understood as that it's part of the intention of what we're going to do. We're going to have a period of practice in which we are going to really value the belief that this practice is good for ourselves and good for the world, which the Buddha says over and over again. It's a training in learning to do what's helpful for you and helpful for the world. And it involves temporarily setting aside concern with the world and shifting your perspective to more of this phenomenological perspective of really trying to understand the inner processes of your own mind. I like this other analogy that I also believe comes from Nisargadatta. He compares, he says, the child plays with the toys, the child attends the toys, but the mother is watching the child. Right? And in that same way, the mind is all involved with what's happening and what does it mean for me and what should I do and how can I change and fix everything. But mindfulness is watching the mind get all dithered and upset and seeing that this isn't actually doing anybody any good. You know, so there's this way in which the mindful part of the mind is aware that this is what is happening. So just as the mother is interested in the child's maybe stage of development or how they're getting along, the mother doesn't care what the dolls are wearing and saying to each other. The mother cares, is the child being creative or relaxed or playful or what, right? So that's a good analogy. Just for a real world example, we often sit down, we have something stressful coming up. Immediately we get into trying to solve the problem. You know, meditation, oh good, 5 minutes, 10 minutes apiece, a time to work on this, what I'm going to say at the meeting tomorrow, right? But instead, if you can just notice that you're doing that, notice that it's agitating, noticing where in the body the agitation is, you know, then, and notice the difference between moments when you slip into thinking, oh, I could say that, and he could say that, and then we'd think that, and moments when you think, wait, that was an imaginary conversation happening in the mind, you know, and I'm sitting here, and when I thought that, I went, because, you know, I'm imagining that that person is going to be angry. And when you can see all that happening, then you're being mindful of the mind's agenda to figure out what it's going to do tomorrow. And the more you can back off of it and give yourself a chance to relax, let your body relax, you're more likely to come up with the right solution in the time. So that's a review of the Buddha's definition. Definition of mindfulness. And then I just want to say I wasn't sure how much of this I'd be able to get through, but the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness contain this definition and then these four areas that it's worth paying this kind of attention to. The body, what's called feeling tones, mind states, and dhammas, which is translated variously, mental processes, factors of the path, seeing the world through the lens of the Dhamma in a very impersonal way. It's a kind of advanced stage of being able to pay attention without any of this interference going on. So this list covers the entire internal world of human experience. And when it's worked with progressively, it leads to recognizing and learning to disidentify more and more from these elements of our experience. So I recently found it very interesting to look at this Anapanasati Sutta. I've studied the Satipatthana Sutta a lot over the years, and it really began to make a different kind of sense to me studying the Anapanasati, which is the mindfulness of breathing, which is a set of 16 steps. I'm not going to have time to go through in detail, but it breaks down, it takes those four elements, and it shows how they can be progressively developed. So this is one way to practice. A more normal and realistic way to practice is that one moment you're aware of the body and one moment you're aware of a mind state, and if you're lucky, you catch a feeling tone here and there, and then you're back to the breath. And so that's perfectly normal, and that does settle down over time. But say if you have really a dedicated wish to make progress through these seven factors of awakening, or you're on a retreat or something, it's very interesting to understand the potential of the flow through these things. So it begins with the body, mindfulness of the body. I've often thought, wouldn't it be great if we just had some kind of biofeedback machine that would tell you when you're being mindful? You know, oh, it's green, I'm being mindful. Well, you have a body, you know? And the body is get to know your body, and you have a giant biofeedback machine as far as how it's going. You know, so you start with mindfulness of the body. And the beauty of this sutta is it carries mindfulness of breathing all the way through. It's not something that you drop and then go on to something else. So you're always embodied, and you're taking into your awareness this holistic sense of how the mind and the body are working together all the time. It begins with just knowing a long breath and a short breath, and then breathing, experiencing the whole body. And I've really appreciated from Ajahn Thanissaro's teaching this deeper understanding of breath as involving the whole circulation system and the energy flow through the whole body, maybe what other systems might call chi or prana or something, but just there's more to it than just the air going in and out of your lungs. It's really how open is your whole body. How open are all the cells and parts of your body to everything that needs to circulate through the body? And by understanding that, you know, you can scan your whole body for openness, then it becomes more interesting sometimes staying with this. And by working with this, you calm the bodily formations. And then the next thing is the feeling tone, which is not so much about feelings as emotions, but the bare sense of pleasant or unpleasant or neither one. And this is really the basis of how this practice works, because mostly we get in trouble because we're so used to denying the actual cost in stress and tension of our various agendas and plans for getting the world to line up and be the way we want it. We are fixated on our mental image of how great it will be when, and we just don't notice what it's costing us to constantly be stressing, trying to make that happen. So as you really become aware of the feeling of stress, or the unpleasant feeling of tension, and the pleasant feeling of relaxing and letting go of tension, that really becomes kind of the what you can orient yourself by and navigate by through this practice. So we're also becoming, at the same time as we're becoming aware of how we're stressing ourselves, we're becoming aware of true lasting pleasure, the sorts of inner happiness and peace and joy that's possible as we start to let go of the other stuff. So mindfulness is sort of like the sun on a garden, is the good news. The more Gil was using this analogy last week, the more the sun shines, it dries up the mold and the mildew, and it lets the flowers bloom, right? So attention actually shrinks, has a tendency to shrink the habits that are based in delusion, because you're supplying some blue or light to the situation, and so you're not so deluded, and so it tends to shrink those things. And there's absolutely, one of the Buddha's great discoveries that he so enjoyed discovering was that there's nothing wrong with this. Pleasure is totally wholesome. This inner peace and inner joy and relaxation, it has no downside. It just leads in a good direction. And so opening up to that is like just letting the flowers bloom, and it's beautiful. And so the more you pay attention and notice and appreciate those states of mind, the more they grow and develop. And you'll be hearing a lot about that over the next few weeks as we explore this whole progression. So then the feeling section of this Anapanasati Sutta leads us through the development of joy and happiness that you'll be hearing more about. And then it's also a great thing. I just wanted to bring in one of my other favorite little quotes from the first book I read by Joko Beck. A line stood out in there. She said, joy is exactly what's happening minus our opinion of it. Which is one of my all-time favorite little pithy things. And so, you know, if we can just let go of our opinion of it, joy. Joy in just surfing along with what's happening. And it's actually one of the other great understandings of Buddhism is that you need this joy to really start to make much of a dent in our craving for sense pleasures. Some of these really hardcore addictions that we have to pleasure, you know, we want pleasure. The body seems to need something that really soothes it and makes it feel good. And we're not going to give up all of our other ways of doing that until we've really, at a deep level, until we've really had a taste of this greater joy. And I still eat a lot and so forth, but I know that I've also tasted this, and it's a touchstone for me that I know better. And, I can work with it. When I can get the space and the time, I can really feel into and access these feelings that make me actually, it's hard to believe, but I've actually sat through lunch on some retreats because I was feeling the pleasure and satisfaction of meditation in a way that I was just completely uninterested in going down for the only meal of the day in some cases. And that's saying a lot. And so that brings me to understand that this is what it means, this statement, that your mind really isn't going to let go of this stuff until it has a pretty reliable substitute. And it does take a lot of practice to get this to be a reliable kind of on-tap substitute for other kinds of pleasure. But anyway, this brings us through gladdening the mind that we have these, that we have this path that brings us this much pleasure, allows us to concentrate and steady the mind in a way that develops this deeper equanimity that you'll be hearing about, where the mind is just not interested in grabbing or resisting the various phenomena. It kind of separates out and just lets it all flow by. And then once we're at equanimity, then the last of the four lead on to the stage of liberation after we've reached this equanimity. I want to allow a little time for discussion here, so I'm going over this part fairly fast. In fact, I think I'll just stop there because that pretty much covers the way that mindfulness supports through those four foundations, the four applications. It goes all the way and supports the settling of the body, using the feeling tone to generate happy states, states of joy, and the joy arises and then naturally settles down to tranquility. You can't make these states of joy and tranquility and concentration. You can't just come and say, today I'm going to make that state come up. You set the conditions for it through mindfulness, through learning how to really just notice what hurts and what feels good, and just trust that something deeply inside you is learning. That's the other meaning that one of the teachers called out, I think Analio's preferred understanding of why sati means remembering, is that it enables remembering. And I do feel that sometimes, that when I'm mindful, I feel like the channel, whatever it is that takes information and feeds it deeply into the system that's learning, into the wisdom level of learning, that channel is open. And I don't have to do anything to try to remember it, to try to put words on it. It's just like if you see it clearly enough, something remembers it, and something knows what to make of it, and it goes into somehow the deep mind that then works on it and might react less next time, for example. Something has learned something that you weren't able to actually make it learn, but it learned. Like we learned language, like we learned everything when we were children, just by really being present and soaking it all in. So I think I'd like to stop there and see if you have any comments or questions on this first basic factor.